This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the United States of America's recent withdrawal from the United Nations Human Rights Council. It's the latest snub of the international community following the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords and the Iran nuclear non-proliferation deal. We speak with Professor Mark Crispin Miller from NYU on the perilous situation that WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange finds himself in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Last week, the United States of America became the first country to voluntarily quit the United Nations 47-member main human rights body, primarily over Washington's claim that the Human Rights Council is biased against Israel. This was the Trump administration's latest snub of the international community. The Human Rights Council is tasked with spotlighting and approving investigations of suspected rights abuses. Never has a member dropped out voluntarily. Diplomats and activists say that the U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley was the driving force behind the decision. Efforts by the United Nations Ambassador Haley to end or water down the routine scrutiny of Israel has failed in recent months at the United Nations General Assembly in New York City. The Human Rights Council addresses an array of concerns, including discrimination, freedom of expression, the rights of women, LGBT people, and people with disabilities. Haley declared that, quote, "We are withdrawing from the United Nations Human Rights Council, an organization which is not worthy of its name." We speak today with Phyllis Bennis. She is a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., where she works on anti-war, U.S. foreign policy, and Palestinian rights issues. She has worked as an informal advisor to several key U.N. officials on Palestinian issues. Her books include Calling the Shots, Washington Dominates Today's U.N., as well as Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, it's really nice to have you back. Phyllis, on June 18th, the United States became the first nation to ever voluntarily pull out of the United Nations Human Rights Council. What's the significance of this?
Well, if we look at it from the vantage point of the United Nations Human Rights Council and say, what's it going to mean? It's going to make things easier to some degree for the diplomats on the council who won't have to deal with the constant haranguings from U.S. officials. It won't change much of what the council does and doesn't do. There's no veto on the council, so the U.S. wasn't able to officially stop the actions of the council. But I think if we look at it from the vantage point of what this says about the Trump administration and the trajectory of the U.S. role in the world, it is very dangerous in that symbolic sense. Not because the U.S. was a supporter of human rights and its loss, as some were claiming, means that the Human Rights Council won't be able to fight for human rights. The U.S. was an impediment, not an advantage to the fight for human rights in the council. But it does take one more step, like pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, like pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, like ending the moves towards normalization of Cuba that had slowly begun to take shape. All of these are pieces of evidence. They're proof of this pulling out of multilateralism, pulling out of diplomacy at the end of the day. So in that sense, it's a very serious, very dangerous moment.
The day before the American pullout, the Human Rights Council outgoing president Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein spoke, warning against what he called the rise of chauvinistic nationalism. He specifically condemned the Trump administration's immigration policy, calling it government-sanctioned child abuse, and he condemned the United States' support of the war against Yemen. Do you think that the U.S. is viewed by other nations as being hypocritical?
Oh, I think hypocritical is the polite term for what other nations are thinking about the U.S. these days. But certainly, this High Commissioner for Human Rights, Prince Zeid, who's actually, ironically enough, a Jordanian prince, but has been very brave, very outspoken, and very willing to take on the U.S. in these essentially rhetorical battles in the context of the Human Rights Council, and it's been very important. Not all people in that position have always been willing to do that. I think that there is an understanding in the rest of the world, and it's been true for a very long time, that the U.S. holds the world in with two standards. It has a separate standard for itself and its closest allies, most particularly Israel, in terms of violations of human rights, violations of international law, and how it, the standards to which it holds the rest of the world, where sometimes violations of human rights will even be at least part of the justification for the U.S. going to war against other countries. That was certainly part of the argument for going to war in Iraq. It was part of the argument around Afghanistan. If you remember Laura Bush and others calling the occupation and invasion of Afghanistan as a victory for women's human rights. So that contradiction, the standards to which it holds itself and the standards to which it holds the rest of the world, is in a sense an old story at the United Nations and around the world, and other nations, people and governments, certainly understand that. They certainly support the efforts to challenge the U.S. But because of U.S. economic and military and diplomatic clout, there's not that many opportunities for other countries to fight back. The Human Rights Council has been one of those venues. And the fact that the U.S. is not going to be on the council this time around, we should note this isn't the first time the U.S., shall we say, gets off the council. The U.S. lost its election to the council back in, I guess it was about 2001, or the first year of the Bush administration. The way the elections happen is by regional groups, and the U.S. is in a Cold War era regional group at the UN called WEOG, Western Europe and Others Group, the others being the white colonial states of Canada, the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand, plus Western Europe. And those countries vote every year for who will represent that group on the Human Rights Council. The U.S. was defeated by Sweden, appropriately enough. Sweden does much better than the U.S. in human rights arenas. And there was outrage in the Bush administration. How dare they exclude us from this very important position? Now, of course, under Trump, we see the U.S. choosing to leave the council.
Had the United States planned to quit the council, was it made well in advance? Because the council had been the human rights situation, had seen the human rights situation in Palestine and Israel and the occupied territories. That was part of their permanent agenda. And do you think that that caused the United States to think in advance of their recent pullout that they were going to pull out?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that this was something quite long planned. This was not a Nikki Haley in a fit of pique saying, we're not going to sit around here, we're going to take our toys and go home. This was not that. This was long-standing, as you say. This was planned ahead of time. The question of Israel coming up for evaluation and attack for its violations, its human rights violations in the council, has been a long-standing point of contention for the United States. It has, we should be clear, made certain over the years that despite a lot of resolutions introduced and a few even passed, Israel has never been seriously held accountable in the United Nations, whether in the Human Rights Council or in the Security Council or anywhere else where there were real consequences for its violations. So all of this, you know, these complaints by the U.S. that only Israel is called up to account, et cetera, is all in a certain way true and in a certain way completely false. It's false in the sense that Israel has never actually faced the consequences of its violations. No Israeli officials, whether political officials or military officials, have ever been judged by the International Criminal Court or even brought up on trial before the International Criminal Court. The U.S. makes sure that its protection of Israel is a key component of its role at the United Nations. So there's been no actual accountability. What there has been a consistent effort by the UN Human Rights Council, various UN special rapporteurs over the years, special envoys who have been sent, and others to investigate and to expose which has been very, very important. I don't want to diminish the significance of that expose role that the Council has allowed over the years in showing Israeli violations and showing the legal basis. It's not simply a political claim that this is Israeli apartheid or this is a violation of human rights. It's backed up by legal assessment, by noted globally recognized legal authorities, and that's very important. But it's also true that Israel does come up for discussion far more frequently than many other countries, precisely because its violations are so consistent and so long-lasting. When you have an occupation that has lasted over 50 years, for example, the violations of the Geneva Conventions in the course of carrying out that occupation, such as the Geneva Convention that prohibits collective punishment, the convention that prohibits transferring population from the occupying power to the territory of the occupied country, all of those violations have to be documented over and over again because they continue. If the violations stopped, the documentation of them would not be so important. But because of the length of these violations, the occupation of the 67 territories, the apartheid systems that are in place inside Israel, all of these are violations of international law and violations of human rights. And particularly because Israel is the only country that is directly and publicly the product of a United Nations decision, the partition decision of 1947, there is appropriately an understanding around the UN that the UN has a particular responsibility to make sure that its existence and its practices are not carrying out consistent violations of human rights, which is unfortunately what the reality is. So, yes, the question of how the UN Human Rights Council deals with Israeli violations is very much at the heart of why the U.S. pulled out. Ironically, the fact that the Council has issued just recently a new report from Philip Alston, the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, and he issued a devastating report after his team spent weeks, months, I think, in the U.S. traveling around meeting with representatives of groups fighting against poverty and with poor people themselves across the country, urban and rural, Appalachia, unemployment-riven cities, everything, and wrote a devastating report, which the U.S. Chose, instead of making a big deal and fighting about it very publicly, chose to ignore, essentially, and simply not acknowledge it. So it's not even the case that when the Council attacked the U.S. itself for its violations, that somehow sparked, oh, my God, they can't do this to us, we're going to leave. It was really all about Israel.
Another, I think, factor was the recent actions of the Israeli army in killing 120 Palestinians who were marching at the border in Gaza and injuring
Absolutely.
Another 14,000 Palestinians. And the United States protected Israel. There was a resolution before the Security Council that Nikki Haley had killed. So I think that was another
right.
aspect of it.
And I think that the resolution that you're referring to, which would have passed 14-0 if, for example, the U.S. had said, we'll simply stand aside, we will abstain and not veto it, was, you know, another factor in angering U.S. policymakers who see their job as being to protect Israel in the United Nations. One of the key roles of the Human Rights Council, of course, precisely because it doesn't have a veto like the Security Council does, has been to take up issues that the Security Council was not able to because of the U.S. veto.
What did you make of Ambassador Haley's threat that if Palestine was not taken off the Human Rights Council permanent agenda, the U.S. would not fund the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which supports 5.9 million Palestinian refugees and their descendants in Gaza and the West Bank and Jordan? What did you make of that threat?
This is a very real threat, and in fact, it's happened already. The U.S., up until a few months ago, was scheduled to pay $360 million, which in the context of the U.S. military budget of $700 billion, for instance, is absolutely chump change and insufficient. according to what the U.S. should pay by any moral standard. But what they actually paid was $300 million less than that. They cut 80% of their pledge. So just two or three days ago, the U.S. sent only $80 million when they were due to send $360 million. $60 million. 80% was cut, and it was $60 million that they sent. That was all. And just a few days ago, the Director General of UNRWA, the aid agency that has been responsible for keeping Palestinian refugees alive, providing food, basic education, basic medical care across, for example, 80% of the population of Gaza, all of the refugee camps in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon, you know, as well as in the West Bank and Gaza themselves. This is a devastating blow, and he announced that he was going to have to consider in the next couple of weeks shortening the school term this year, not starting school when it's usually scheduled to begin in mid-August, but waiting until September. They would have to cut some of the direct aid to the poorest among the refugees. It's going to have devastating impact on real human beings, real families that are struggling to survive. If we're talking, for example, in Gaza, where 80% of the population are refugees, the UN has said that by 2020, which is less than 2 years away, Gaza will be completely uninhabitable. They have said that that might even happen sooner. 93% of the little bit of water available in Gaza is undrinkable because of contamination, because there's been no rebuilding of the water treatment plant. So these kinds of stark realities facing an already devastated refugee population who is now in their fourth generation of being refugees. The reason that the key is the symbol of the Palestinian refugees' struggle to go home, the key is the symbol because when people were forced off their land in 1947 and 48, they took their keys with them. They locked their doors of their houses and took their keys because they thought they would be home in 2 weeks or 3 weeks when the fighting ended. They were never allowed to go home, despite international law, despite UN Resolution 194 that specifically speaks of the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. Despite all of that, with U.S. protection, Israel has simply said, no, we're not going to do it because it would change the demographic nature of our country. And the answer is, of course it would. That's part of the point, that you're not allowed to have a country that's made up of a forced majority based on excluding by force the indigenous population who once lived there. So this is a part of a much bigger issue.
And now we're anticipating Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, coming up with a plan to resolve the situation between Israel and the Palestinians. And do you think part of that plan will allow people to come back?
No. It will absolutely not allow a single person to come back. What it will do is say that hopes of return are over, get over it. Hopes of a Palestinian capital and a real state are over, get over it. I think what they are going, we're getting leaks of what this report or proposal will say. We don't have the whole text yet. But what it seems to say is that Jerusalem is off the table, as we had all anticipated when the U.S. announced that it was now recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It's no longer up for negotiation, so the Palestinian, quote, capital of a, quote, state, with lots of air quotes here, the capital will be in a little village known as Abu Dis. This is a place that many Israeli officials have claimed over the years could become the next, the real capital of a Palestinian state. And it says, and they said, and look, we'll even let you call it El Quds, which is Jerusalem in Arabic. But what that means is essentially it's like saying, you want your capital in New York, you have the right to have your capital in New York. Well, okay, but you know what? It's not going to really be in New York. It's going to be in Newark, but we'll let you call it New York. Yeah. And the problem is you can call it whatever you want, but everybody knows it's not New York. No offense to Newark, but it's not New York. And, you know, this is the equivalent of that on steroids. Abu Dis is a dusty little village at the end, literally, of the Silk Road. I was there a few years ago with Richard Falk, who shortly after our trip became the special rapporteur on Palestine for the United Nations. And we went to Abu Dis. There's a good university there, among other things, but it's a dusty little village that literally the wall, the apartheid wall that cuts through the West Bank, cuts right through Abu Dis at the end of what used to be the Silk Road, cutting off access to the sea. It cuts off Abu Dis from the rest of Palestinian territory that surrounds it. So this is what is now being talked about, and the trade-off is going to be not real sovereignty. There's no claim that Israel will pull out. Israeli settlements, 80% of the settlers will remain, at least. And that's, again, this is what we're hearing. These are leaks. This is not final. It may be that the leaks are deliberate to kind of weigh what the response is going to be. We don't know. But there will be, the settlements will remain. They will remain under Israeli authority. Israel will control borders. Israel will control the airspace and the coasts. Palestine, whether it's allowed to be called that or not, will not be allowed to have a military. It will be forcibly disarmed from outside. And the trade-off will be money. Billions and billions of dollars and shekels and rubles and whatever else. Primarily, I think they're going to claim it's going to be paid for by the Saudis. This is sort of the equivalent of Trump's claim that we're going to have a wall, it's going to be a big, beautiful wall, and Mexico is going to pay for it. He's saying we're going to have a great agreement, the best agreement in history, and the Saudis are going to pay for it. Yeah. The problem is that's a very big if, partly because the Saudi crown prince, who is responsible for all this, who has become BFF with Jared Kushner, the two crown princes, if you will, is very interested in this proposal. But he still has to answer to the king, his father, who is not completely out of the picture yet. He's mostly out of the picture, but not entirely. And whether he's going to sign off on such a thing, given that he was responsible for what is still seen as the most popular Arab government proposal around, the old Arab peace initiative of now about 10 years ago or more, whether he's going to be willing to give that up and instead pay for an agreement that will essentially write off Palestinian rights and make him responsible for writing off Palestinian rights, that remains a very big question.
Getting back to the Human Rights Council, with respect to U.S. policy against Iran and Venezuela and Cuba, what was the attitude of most of the members of the Human Rights Council when the United States announced its and practices its policy against Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba?
Well, the U.S. rarely tried to use the Human Rights Council as a major venue for its U.N. efforts to target those countries. With Cuba, for instance, it was always playing defense. And what would happen every year was that the General Assembly, which is by far the most democratic organ of the United Nations, the General Assembly would vote every year on a resolution condemning the U.S. embargo against Cuba, the U.S. blockade. And it would always be support, the opposition for it would come from the U.S. and Israel, plus four small island states, the Solomon Islands, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Nauru, most of whom have constitutional requirements that they align their foreign policy with the United States because the U.S. pays big parts of their budgets. So the notion that this is somehow representative of real, you know, governments is a bit fallacious. But there would be massive support for the resolution condemning the U.S. positions. So the U.S. rarely tried to use there were occasions, but they never got much support, and they never really tried serious enforcement in those arenas. But the reality is that what happens in the case, say, with Iran, for instance, the U.N. sanctions against Iran that were nuclear-linked have been lifted with the passage of the Iran nuclear deal. And even with the U.S. pulling out of that deal, those sanctions have not been reimposed and won't be. The problem is that the U.S. unilateral sanctions that are not explicitly linked to the nuclear question, those remain in place. And other nations end up being accountable to that because they're afraid sometimes that if their banks, for instance, are willing to trade with companies in Iran, or if they're willing to buy Iranian goods or sell goods to Iran, that somehow they will pay a price in their ability to trade with the U.S. because the U.S. puts in place these unilateral moves, as they've done with Cuba and other countries, where they say, for example, with cruise ships, any cruise ship that goes, that stops in a Cuban port is barred from coming to the United States for at least 6 months. So when cruise line owners are figuring out their itineraries, they have to weigh what's the value of going to Cuba versus going to this much bigger market in the United States. So even though it's not supported by the United Nations, it's not a UN decision, it's opposed massively in the UN, it still ends up having a multilateral impact because of the power of the U.S. economy.
What about Venezuela? The United States has vigorously been trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela. And a recent report showed that the Venezuelan elections were the most democratic in the world. But the United States says no, that it's a Maduro dictatorship. What does the Human Rights Council say about that, if anything?
I'm not aware of anything from the Human Rights Council. I mean, I think there are different assessments of the developments of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela since the death of Chavez and Maduro's accession. I mean, I don't think that's a settled question among progressives, but I don't think that there's been an effort to use the Human Rights Council per se as a venue for that.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, when the United States made the announcement about pulling out of the Human Rights Council, he denounced it for being shameless hypocrites. And he said that it contains some of the world's most serious offenders sitting on the council itself. Is that true?
You know, it's so ironic. It has included some of the worst offenders, including the United States. So has that been true ever? Of course it has. The reality is that most of the regional groups, that's the way the UN is organized. It's this, as I mentioned earlier, it's a holdover from the Cold War. You have these groups that were really not geographic, like Latin America is a group, but North America is not a group. North America has Mexico in with Latin America and the U.S. and Canada part of this weird WEOG group, Western Europe and others. And then you have a whole separate group for Eastern Europe, which would not ordinarily be big enough for its own group. You don't have a Middle East group. You have Asia and Africa, you know, so you have some huge groups and then some smaller groups. It's a very weird setting. But most of them have their decision-making in terms of who sits on the council on a rotational basis. So every country sits, whether it has a good or bad record. So you can have Uzbekistan sitting on the council as likely as you're going to have Sweden sitting on the council. So at various times, every country in the world practically has been on the council. So, you know, when Pompeo says that, I have a feeling he's not talking about the United States, but it's a rhetorical point more than anything else. In fact, for some countries, some of the Scandinavians and others have said that they think it's actually a good thing for some of these terrible violators of political rights, and it generally is of political rights, to be on the council because there can be a name and shaming internal process as well. I don't know for sure that that's true, but I think one of the things it also reflects, and we should be clear about this, is that one of the big problems with how the U.S. talks about human rights is that it consistently divides human rights into two separate categories because there's these two separate conventions dealing with human rights. So there's one set of human rights known as civil and political rights. Those are the only ones the U.S. likes to talk about. That has to do with voting, it has to do with elections, it has to do with representation, that sort of thing. How you define a democracy, you know, all that stuff. What it is separated from is the economic, social, and cultural rights, which are things like the right to food, the right to health care, the right to clean water, the rights of children. Those things are consistently and legally violated by the United States, legally in terms of U.S. law, which does not recognize health care as a right, the only industrialized country that doesn't. It doesn't recognize the Convention on the Rights of Children because it wants to make sure 17-year-olds can be recruited into the military. It doesn't recognize the right to water. It focuses, when Pompeo talks about violators of human rights, he's not talking about his own country, and he's not talking about allied countries. And he's not talking about countries that may, because of corruption at the top, still have systems in place that make sure that their own populations don't have access to adequate food or water or medical care, which are also human rights. He's talking solely about those political rights of opponents of the U.S. So it's a very, very narrow definition. I would say that that's not particular. That's one thing that's not particular to the U.S. Pretty much every country in the world, every government in the world, identifies human rights violators politically. There's almost no governments, there's a few on occasion, when the International Criminal Court was created and other times, but those are rare moments. Most of the time, pretty much every government identifies human rights violators on the basis of which who are its political opponents in the world. So the U.S. isn't unique in that sense. Where the U.S. is completely unique is at the scale of its own violations, which remain completely unacknowledged, unresponded to, and denied as being violations at all.
We're speaking with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of the book called Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's United Nations. Phyllis, before we have to say goodbye because we're coming to an end of our allotted time, I wanted to ask you about the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling banning Muslims from five predominantly Muslim countries. What was your reaction when you heard about that ruling, and how do you think it'll affect the United States policy and the way the world looks at the United States?
One of the most horrifying decisions of the Supreme Court that we've had since the Karamazov decision that legitimized rounding up and imprisoning Japanese and Japanese Americans in World War II, something that has for so long been recognized as one of the low points, not the only. We have the Dred Scott decision, we have other things, but one of the many low points of the U.S. Supreme Court. This was an outrage. This was an outrage. The fact that the majority opinion acknowledges publicly the outrageous, racist, Islamophobic remarks of Trump as a candidate and Trump as a president, and the actions of his administration to implement those Islamophobic threats and demands, and says, but as long as they can provide some kind of an arguably acceptable basis to justify why there should be this kind of a Muslim ban, then it's okay. Then we can put aside all of his proven racism, his proven Islamophobia, his proven, in their words, animus against Muslims. We can just ignore all that and say, well, they didn't use that language in the law. The law sounds very neutral. It doesn't sound Islamophobic, so we're going to accept it at face value and not interfere. That's our job, to not interfere. It's a complete backwards reading of any understanding of the job of the Supreme Court to uphold the Constitution's claims, so often ignored, so often violated, but the Constitution's claims to protect everyone equally. This is absolutely flying in the face of that. And aside from the horrific impact it's going to have on Muslims in the United States, who are now facing family separation, who can't even anticipate when they will see some of their families who might be back home, aside from that, the impact on U.S. foreign policy is going to make it harder and harder for the U.S. to make claims internationally that it is not fighting the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan because it's against Muslims. Now there's a Supreme Court position, a Supreme Court decision, a binding decision, saying it's fine to discriminate against Muslims because it's necessary for our national defense. The justification for U.S. wars becomes legitimately going after Muslims. That's now the position of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's shameful, it's an outrage, and the only thing one can say about it is that, thankfully, as has happened already, it has inspired an even wider sector of the population to respond with incredible outrage towards this.
And I would add that it really underlines the drift towards a authoritarian state in the United States when Trump can make these decisions alone on the basis of what he decides is national security. That's the hallmark of an authoritarian state with its underlying racism, an authoritarian state with a whiff of fascism.
We have to be very clear about that, that this is one more step towards that kind of consolidating one-man power. And it's a terribly dangerous moment for our country and for the world, because what happens here has impacts around the world.
Phyllis Bennis, unfortunately, we're going to have to say goodbye. But before we do, please tell our audience how people can follow your work and that of the work of the Institute for Policy Studies.
Sure. Our website is ips-dc.org, ips-dc.org. Within that, you can go to my page or my project, the New Internationalism Project, and you'll see all of our recent work.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for returning to Law and Disorder. It's always very enlightening for me to be able to speak with you. You stay cool down there in Washington, D.C., where it's probably going to be 100 degrees, and I hope that we'll talk to you soon.
I look forward to it, Michael. Thanks very much.
Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
WikiLeaks founder, the truth-telling publisher Julian Assange, is in escalating danger of being sent from England to America, where he would likely be tried for espionage, a crime that carries the death penalty. Assange and WikiLeaks have revealed American war crimes in the Middle East, CIA global machinations, and the work of the Clinton Democrats in preventing the popular Bernie Sanders from heading up the party ticket. Assange is presently holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was granted political asylum 6 years ago by past leftist president Rafael Correa. But now, with the change of presidents in Ecuador, Assange has been cut off from the outside world. He has no phone, no computer, and no visitors. The fresh offensive against him occurred the day after American General Joseph DeSalvo, the head of the U.S. Southern Command, the Pentagon's arm in Latin America, visited the new right-wing Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno. Moreno has said that Assange is, quote, an inherited problem, and is seeking a better relationship with the United States government, to whom he has already granted a military base. Here to speak with us today about the danger to Julian Assange and to independent media is Mark Crispin Miller, who is a professor of media studies at New York University. Professor Miller has frequently spoken out about media propaganda, the engineering of consent for empire, fake news, and the destruction of the independent press. He has been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship for the Humanities and is a vigorous defender of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Mark Crispin Miller, welcome to Law and Disorder. Mark Crispin Miller, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
First, let's talk about what is WikiLeaks and what contribution has WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange, contributed to our understanding of the U.S. government's role in the world?
Well, it's crucial to understand the fundamental truth that WikiLeaks is a publishing organization. That's what it is. It publishes documents. It makes revelations that have been suppressed by the state so that we can get a good, clear look into the kitchen, as it were, of Western policy, especially foreign policy. It is, I repeat, a journalistic organization. Now, we tend these days, and have tended for some time, to think that journalists can only be people who've gone to journalism school, gotten duly accredited, and gone to work for one or the other of the major corporate news organizations. Okay, this would have come as news to the framers of the Constitution. Anyone who publishes information is by definition a journalist. So freedom of the press actually applies to any citizen of a democracy. WikiLeaks has a perfect record of accuracy, having released something like 40,000 documents over the years. Never once has anybody been able to claim, even much less prove, that any of those documents were bogus. The New York Times should boast such a stellar record of accuracy. So there's no fake news coming out of WikiLeaks. In this case, all the fake news is directed at Julian Assange.
What kind of material has WikiLeaks published, and how does that contribute to our understanding of the way the U.S. government works in the world?
Well, it isn't just the U.S. government. It's states across the board. And what makes WikiLeaks so valuable is the fact that its primary documents, stuff that comes straight from the belly of the beast, has functioned to contradict various propaganda narratives that the state puts out. Nothing could be more important than that. It seems to me that the function of real journalism is always to rebut or expose the falseness of propaganda. I mean, we're absolutely drowning in propaganda. You know, it's like a thermal inversion. So you get a kind of heroic picture of, you know, the war in Iraq, for example. We're over there fighting for freedom in some vague way. Nobody really knows why. Then you look at the gunship videos that were released by WikiLeaks. You see that it's just a slaughter. It is a matter of picking off civilians. The same with the DNC emails, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in a moment. But there we got to look at what the DNC and the Clinton campaign were really up to throughout the primary season. Completely different from the spin that the establishment press was putting on that political cycle. In a way, the fact that the material that WikiLeaks gives us is unfiltered, you know, they're giving it to us straight, basically. And they're also providing a signal service to news organizations, giving them a staggering abundance of hot material that they should be using to make the truth about them clear to the larger public.
What moves are afoot to force Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's taken refuge?
Well, I mean, there's obviously, you know, stuff going on behind the scenes to muscle the new government of Ecuador into turning him over. I'd even go so far as to say that the installation of this new president was probably the result of various covert activities meant to get rid of Correa, who was the one who gave Assange asylum, in favor of a head of state who would be more amenable, you know, and so on. And I can't speak really authoritatively to that because this stuff is all hidden from us. The more important and horrifying set of tactics that are being used to get Assange out of there amounts to torture, as far as I'm concerned. Solitary confinement. He's being held incommunicado. He is being denied urgent medical assistance. I mean, right before our eyes, in a way, we have this man being subjected to horrendous mistreatment that would have everybody in our establishment up in arms if it were happening to some journalist in China or, you know, Iran. But because it's Julian Assange and we think of him as a tool of Putin, I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of propaganda fog pumped at and around him. We just let it go. But it is an outrage. You know, it seems to me to be a criminal act.
Well, they've cut him off from his computer, from the outside world. No visitors, no email.
Right. Incommunicado.
He can't go outside, doesn't get sunshine, wants to go to the doctor. He needs medical care. They won't let him do it.
Right, right. It would be completely unacceptable at any of our major prisons for civilians.
Another thing that they've done to him, the British newspaper, The Guardian, is charging Assange with violating the embassy's communication system and apparently reading confidential diplomatic traffic. And Assange has been silenced, so he can't even respond to that. Do you think that this is part of the British and United States onslaught to force Ecuador to renege on its asylum which they granted him 6 years ago?
Well, absolutely. That and the ever-expanding police presence outside the embassy, these are strong-arm tactics. That stuff in The Guardian is disinformation, okay? It can't be trusted. The Guardian is a rag, okay? It's a propaganda rag, just like The New York Times. And I'm not – this is not hyperbole, okay? It may sound extreme to people who haven't awakened to the facts. But these mainstream news organizations with their august histories are now simply conduits for state propaganda of the crudest kind. Focus Ecuador, the outfit that supposedly provided The Guardian with this information, has given them forged documents in the past. So we're talking about what amounts to an intelligence operation to basically force Assange out of those out of that haven and into the loving embrace of the United States.
Well, that anticipates my next question. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has said that putting Assange on trial for espionage is what he says a priority, and that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has declared that WikiLeaks is a, quote, non-state hostile intelligence service. Your thoughts on that?
But that, you know, that kind of takes my breath away. What does that even mean? All they do is provide the world public with important information. You know, they don't put any troops at risk. They aren't naming intelligence officers. They're basically giving us a lot of uncomfortable truths. And in the world we live in now, that amounts to an act of terror. I think that across the board, the states that now call the shots, you know, the U.S. especially, and Britain and Israel and others, what we call the West, you know. The West is primarily engaged these days in promoting and above all protecting a set of propaganda narratives that have never been more dangerous on the one hand, and yet that have never been more vulnerable. You know, the credibility of governments, the credibility of the media establishment, such credibility has never been lower. Fewer people trust what they hear than ever before. So there's a kind of desperation, you can sense it, in the way that the government, through the corporate media, polices what we're thinking, polices what we see and read, tells us what's fake news and what isn't. And in this regard, you know, the rise of Donald Trump has been kind of a stroke of genius, because Trump, on the one hand, of course, is a pathological liar. You know, when he moves his lips, he's usually lying. The press takes great pleasure in quantifying his lies. You know, since coming to office, Donald Trump has lied 7,422 times. Okay, let's look at those lies. The lies are ridiculous, trivial, blatant. You know, practically everybody can see that they're lies, and they don't count. They don't matter. The size of his inauguration crowd, big deal. Well, all that lying of his allows the Times and the Guardian and the rest of them to get up on their high horse and posture as the champions of truth when they're the ones who are promoting lies that are far more destructive than the ones that Trump tells. First of all, because most people, at least educated people, believe them. And second of all, because they have to do with matters of life and death. You know, to lie about the chemical attacks in Syria, to lie about Russiagate, is to push war propaganda that could have really catastrophic consequences. These are huge, huge lies. And you know, these lethal lies extend into various other fields, you know, public health and so on. The fact is that both sides are lying like crazy. The system is utterly corrupt. More and more people know it. So there's a kind of hysteria, you know, that I and others can sense at the top, as the you know, material in the press has never been more false and has never been more strident in its insistence that those lies are true.
Last month, the Democratic National Committee launched a lawsuit against WikiLeaks and Assange as co-conspirators with Russia and the Trump campaign in a supposed criminal effort to steal the 2016 presidential election. In reality, What did the documents WikiLeaks published show about the DNC and the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a typical kind of a disinformation tactic to distract from the content of the information revealed to the circumstances of its release, right? So they don't want people to focus on the fact that the documents show, among other things, that the DNC was heavily biased against Bernie Sanders and did everything it could to throw the primary elections to Hillary Clinton. They also revealed that the corporate press, you know, Rachel Maddow, Maggie Haberman of the Times, all these august figures throughout the media were basically working hand in glove with the Clinton campaign, sometimes even offering to run copy past them for approval, you know, the most abject kind of servitude, or we could say partisanship, that ought to have resulted in their being fired as journalists, right? This comes across in those emails, right, which WikiLeaks simply publicized.
They're saying that WikiLeaks hacked into the DNC computer.
Right.
And Ray McGovern was on our show, Law and Disorder, several months ago, explaining that the information from the DNC computer was not hacked, but leaked, and likely leaked from a disgruntled staffer.
Well, right. This speaks to the great fog known as Russiagate. You know, we're told they hacked the election. What does that mean? Do they hack voting machines? No, no, Obama said. No, no, Comey said. They bent over backwards to say that didn't happen, because one of the big lies they tell is that it never happens. Elections are never stolen in the United States. No, that didn't happen. What happened was they flooded the atmosphere with pro-Hillary propaganda and hypnotized the electorate into favoring Trump over Hillary. And then that morphed into the $100,000 worth of Facebook ads, you know, most of which turn out not to have anything to do with supporting Trump and so on. The fact is that Julian Assange himself, Craig Murray, the diplomat who has worked closely with Assange, have both said that those emails were not hacked, that they were leaked. There was then an anonymous analysis of the data, forensic analysis of how those emails were acquired, that found that they were, in fact, leaked, not hacked. On the basis of that anonymous analysis, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, VIPS, which is the group that Ray's part of, and there are some very heavy hitters in that group,
yeah,
including William Binney of the NSA, they confirmed, largely confirmed, the findings of that analysis, that basically the disappearance of the emails or the removal of those emails from that archive of data was too quick to have been the result of a hack. They had to have been downloaded onto a thumb drive. The likeliest candidate is, of course, Seth Rich. And if you do a search on the name Seth Rich and the New York Times, for example, there again, you'll find reams of hysterical denial that there's anything whatsoever to that. This is fake news. This is a hoax, you know. Let me say that anytime you read throughout the press that a story is a hoax and a fake and fake news and a lie and false, I think you can rest assured that it's probably true. Otherwise, they wouldn't be flipping out about it like that.
Let's talk about political asylum when it's granted and can it be taken away. I'm thinking now not just of Julian, but what the United States is doing when people and their children are coming here seeking asylum. Instead of being given a hearing on the bona fides of their contentions on why they need asylum, instead their children are being taken away from them, and then they're given a trial, and then they're sent back. What do you think of the concept of asylum, which is, I had thought, sacred in American and international law, and it seems to be being eroded?
Well, it is definitely being eroded. I would note, though, that these are actually two different things, both horrendous, and you were right to bring them both up as unacceptable, because Assange already has been granted asylum, okay? He was given asylum by the former president of Ecuador. these families that are coming to the United States primarily because of economic and military depredations that the U.S. is responsible for, they are seeking asylum and they are being denied it. Okay, so in Assange's case, it's a question of whether or not once you've been given political asylum, can it be taken away for political reasons? Naturally, my impulse is to say it shouldn't be. That is a hopelessly idealistic position. But the fact is, let's broaden the point you're making to say that all the usual ethical and moral norms that have either obtained or that have seemingly obtained in the West for the last century or so have been thrown out the window. And it didn't start with Trump, okay? There are a lot of people out there who think that if Donald Trump disappeared, the United States would turn into a land of peace and universal brotherhood and perfect justice. That is not the case. It was Barack Obama who was the first president to engage in the summary execution of American citizens, right? So Barack Obama actually was said by the ACLU to have the worst record on civil liberties of any president in U.S. history. So I think we can actually ascribe the torment of Julian Assange to the Obama administration. Frankly, you know, what I'd like to see is an enormous mob of people just, you know, descending on the Ecuadorian embassy in London and hustling Julian off to some safe place or at least reconnecting his internet.
So what can our listeners do to help?
What can they do to help? Let me see. I think they can contribute to Julian Assange's legal defense fund, which the link is on the WikiLeaks website. And they can buy stuff from the WikiLeaks shop. These are ways to help support him financially. They should also do what we're trying to do, you know, which is to share accurate information about what's happened to him. And if you don't have access to a forum like this, you spread the word about shows like this, and you let people know that there's another side to the story. There's also WikiLeaks' own tweets, which people should share, because those are pretty much authoritative. And I also would urge people to write cards and letters to Julian.
And how do you do that?
Well, here's his address. It's Julian Assange, care of the Ecuadorian Embassy, flat 3B, that's 3B as in boy, 3 Hans Crescent, that's Hans Crescent, London, SW1XOLS.
Mark Crispin Miller, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We'll have you back. Okay. Thank you again.
It'll be a pleasure to come back. Thanks.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web.